So I wanted to ask Candy to go up there. Dr. Farb, who's one of my colleagues at FDA, came up with some good questions, and we worked on these together, are what we consider are the issues for regulatory approval, but they're really just issues to be put out here so that we can have a good, healthy discussion about them around the table. Andy?
Thanks, Ileana. And so we're going to propose some questions regarding clinical trials. We'd like to generate some discussion. So these are set out as statements, but they're really questions. So to gain approval, a heart failure monitoring device must be shown to reduce the rate of repeat heart failure hospitalization compared to optimal medical therapy. How long after hospitalization? 30, 60, or 90 days, and the effect size must be clinically significant, not merely statistically significant, for patients and payers. So this gets to what is the greatest unmet need, what are these devices intended to do in terms of what are they intended to improve with respect to patient care, and we throw that out to the panel and the audience for discussion for comment.
Anybody on the panel? Just to clarify the reason, the 30, 60, and 90-day, there have been debates in other monitoring trials about should we look at an endpoint at 30 days or at 60 days. When I personally look at the Get With The Guidelines data, which is pretty powerful and prospectively collected, most events happen before 60 days, and certainly the rate is even higher in the first 2 weeks if you want to really look at rates. Jeff?
Yeah, I would restate something I said earlier and Ken commented on. Heart failure monitoring device is not what's being judged. It's the heart failure monitoring device and what you do about it that's being judged. As Bill said, it's a strategy. And so I think it's very important to think about it in that way. How long after hospitalization? Well, you know, anyone can have an opinion, but I'll give you a basis for an opinion, 30 days. Because if it's less than 30 days, the hospital will pay and the government will not. So certainly, as a practical matter, right now in the United States, it's very important to prevent rehospitalization for at least 30 days. Is that medically, socially, or otherwise important? Oh, I don't know, but certainly it's financially very important in the United States. And that's one basis for selecting an endpoint.
And remember, when we're thinking about trials, we have to think about feasibility, we have to think about costs, it has to be completed in our lifetime. Ken?
Yeah, I mean, I just to point out, right, this is a very different standard than is used for other diagnostic devices, I would say any other diagnostic devices of which I'm aware. I think next door right now, they're either having or they just concluded a whole biomarker session where none of the biomarkers that have been approved for use have been subjected to any kind of scrutiny like this prospectively. And so I think the first question I have is, this is a very general statement, a heart failure monitoring device. Do you think about it differently if it's an implantable versus a non-invasive device? And do you think about it differently if it's a standalone device versus something that's integrated into a device that's going to be implanted no matter what?
Yeah, you bring a great point, and I think it is very different. If the patient is going to get the device strictly for monitoring, it's a very different thing because now you have the risk of the device going in than if you say, all these weight monitors have not gone through the scrutiny. They're not implantable, and they get approval simply because they monitor weight and they monitor symptoms. But this is implantable, so there is a difference. And if it's included already in an ICD or in a CRT that's going to go in anyway, and the patient is a candidate, also a different bar.
And from a regulatory standpoint, you highlight the difference between a tool claim, measurement of some physiologic parameter versus a diagnostic claim, and most of our tools follow the more lower bar of the 510K pathway into the U.S. Bill?
Yeah, I guess I want to argue a bit that, if we're going to raise the bar to a relatively high level for implantable devices, since we're informing therapy, and that informed therapy may have either a beneficial or a detrimental effect on patient, that we should hold non-invasive devices to the same bar. And what really drove this home for me is that the device, the system, which is commercially available that was used in the tele-HF trial, if you had looked at the website for that device prior to the report of the tele-HF trial, they reported a 60% reduction in heart failure hospitalization on the basis of small trials, mostly observational, mostly single center. And when a 1,600 some odd patient randomized controlled trial was done, there wasn't any difference. And so, you know, we've got folks out there making pretty big claims, and we've got payers and we've got health systems that are using those devices on the basis of what turn out to often be unsubstantiated or poorly substantiated claims. So, I think we should, you know, have a fairly even. I understand the risk-benefit piece as far as the device implant goes. That adds an additional, you know, potential for risk. But when you look beyond that, if you look at the monitoring versus benefit, you know, ratio, you know, there's not really, I don't see really much of a difference.
And then,
yes, I don't have the experience that Bill has of being part of the CHAMPION trial. My only reflection here is 30 days really long enough for the investigator, even giving solid advice what to do? We learn to manage a patient. I would perhaps think it would be a little bit longer and then to give them a fair chance of proving that they're achieving something beneficial, because not everybody is an expert. Even given solid advice, perhaps it takes a little bit of time to learn to use it.
Yeah, you highlight the educational issues. Jay? Sake of time. Did you have a quick comment, Jay?
I think the diagnostic issue has been discussed. And I would just say I think the risk-benefit calculation is important. Not all implants are alike, and if you've got an implant where the risk is the same as a right heart catheterization and you're potentially preventing additional right heart catheterization, let alone hospitalization, that should be in the calculus somewhere, which we don't really do. I guess I'm a little confused about point number two. Could you clarify that? Are you meaning the index hospitalization? What time period are you referring to?
No, I'm saying that very often discussions, I just open this up for discussion. When should we be measuring a hospitalization or a rehospitalization? And I think Jeff made the great point that in people who have been hospitalized, which I think is a majority of these patients, the 30-day rehospitalization rate right now is so critical in the U.S., but you may want to look at 60 days and you may want to look at 90 days and see if you reduce the 30-day, does that, you know, end up in a further reduction down the line. So this is totally open for discussion. There's no right or wrong.
Well, you know, I think it's a great point, and I think, and you're right, the risk is highest in the immediate peri-index hospitalization period, and actually that's relatively easy, in quotation marks, to influence. What's much harder to influence is the chronic heart failure hospitalization rate, and the goal in CHAMPION and the COMPASS trial and so forth was that longer term hospitalization rate. So I think that's interesting. But even in CHAMPION, we have not presented this data, but the immediate rehospitalization rate is substantially reduced to 30 days.
I think the point about risk-benefit principles that you and Bill brought up is also very important. It's, we're trying to incorporate a lot of that thinking in our regulatory decision-making. So next statement, in clinical trials, only treating physicians at clinical study sites should have access to the output of heart failure monitoring devices reflected expected real-world use. And I think this gets to the intervention package that one might see in a clinical trial versus what would really translate in the community.
I think this is a great point, and I think we've had a great discussion, and I think there's room for sort of nuance and moderation. I think we should provide guidelines, but we should not be prescriptive. We have to respect the expertise and knowledge of the physician taking care of that patient. Certainly, when I did interventional trials, the companies, the trials would provide guidelines on stent usage, but ultimately I made the decision on how to treat that particular lesion in that particular patient. And I'm not sure why heart failure cardiology should be treated with any less respect for their expertise. And we should provide guidelines, we should provide targets. As Bill said, this is the pressure we want. we should give him, you know, a recipe, but the actual prescriptive powers for that particular patient, I think it's pointed out, you know, if they're hypotensive, well, you've got to take that into account. And so that should be left to that physician. And I think, so in answer to this question, then it should really be the treating physician at the clinical site who's got adequate information, has that adequate training, and should not be the family practitioner or the internist, as the example you were mentioning, Ileana. You know, they may have no interest in even learning anything new. So it should be limited to the cardiologist who's implanting the device and dealing with the patient, would be my suggestion.
I have a question from Brazil.
Okay. So in general, I agree with Jay's comments, except I think, you know, one of the things that has been long tradition in medicine, particularly in regard to introduction of new therapies or strategies, is the ability to interact with peers and to learn. So, you know, I'll use the example of beta blockers. Those of us who were involved in early beta blocker trials subsequently served as resources for colleagues who struggled to titrate beta blockers, and we made ourselves available to talk to them and to guide them and to give them suggestions on how to adequately titrate beta blockers. Similarly, I think with, you know, these monitoring strategies, we need to take the collective knowledge of the past 20 years, and we need to, you know, convey that to peers. So while I agree that, you know, in general, this should be in the hands, and the treatment decision should always be, you know, in the hands of the local physician, I think systems which allow, you know, some interaction between peers, or, you know, if a sponsor wants to provide that, GSK did when carvedilol was released, they made, you know, people like me available to talk to new users of carvedilol for heart failure. To make that type of peer-to-peer interaction available so that new users can make informed decisions is not unreasonable.
So we have a question from Brazil that says, what is clinically significant? So that's a question for the panel. And added to clinically significant may not be cost-effective. Comments? Jeff?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. The words clinically significant are used very frequently, and I don't think there's a definition that we would all agree upon. I think that what is clinically, and I won't use the word significant, but clinically important, significant I assume I associate with a comparison that's made in a formal way. A clinically important change is one that you believe has a meaningful impact on the lifestyle or length of life of a patient. In general, drugs have been approved for heart failure, for treating patients with heart failure, when they alter some major outcome, hospitalizations, mortality, whatever it is, by at least 15%. And I would say that's a reasonable bar. If you wanted to make an argument that 10% is good enough, well, that might be true if the risk associated with the use of the new therapy and the cost of the new therapy were low enough so you and the patient were willing to accept them. But I don't think there's an absolute here. And the issue of the cost, which you raised, is really important in answering that question. It's got to be considered.
You want to go on to debate issue 3? And again, these are just put up here to give us the door to start discussion. So the value added derived from heart failure monitoring devices cannot be accurately determined unless study subjects are treated with guideline-specified medications administered at their target doses. Comments?
I'll call on Bill because I'm sure he'll have a comment.
I think that as a principle, that's absolutely reasonable. The problem is the at their targeted doses, because I would have to alter that statement a little bit if I were going to accept it to say at their targeted dose or maximally tolerated dose. You can't put everybody on the target dose. They can't tolerate it. And if you look only at people who can tolerate the target doses of the specific cocktail of medications we now give, you're not going to be able to generalize the data to a large heart failure population, because that's a relatively small portion of the heart failure population.
Yeah, so I think that this paradigm makes a lot of sense for treatment trials of drugs or devices that directly provide treatment. You know, for monitoring trials, while this has been the benchmark we've required, it's always seemed to be a little bit strange to me because if access to monitoring information allows better titration of these medicines, and that also contributes to the improved outcome, it's still a benefit of the monitoring system. I do believe that even in patients who we think we've gotten to best tolerated doses of neurohormonal inhibitors and antagonists, when I know the pulmonary artery pressure, I can often get them up another step or another level. That's an advantage. If I didn't have the pressure information, they'd stay on, 20 milligrams of lisinopril. And now that I have that knowledge, I can take them to 40 milligrams. And that I see actually as a benefit of the monitoring. I understand there are, problems with potential confounding, but maybe if it's seen as part of the method of use and potential benefit of the monitoring system, you don't have to require this going in for everybody.
So just for the audience, we will be testing that hypothesis with BNP. If the randomized group, one group will be targeting a BNP, sort of equivalent to targeting a pressure, but without any monitoring device, and the other group will be told to continue to tweak, because I agree with Bill, you can always tweak a little bit more if you sit down and you take a good look at the patient, and their blood pressure has gotten a little bit better, maybe now is the time to push up the ACE a little bit. So we will be testing that strategy in BNP based on some preliminary data that we have that's pretty powerful from the PROTECT trial.
And this one gets to the differences between a clinical trial, especially on the control group side, and what goes on in the community where we see a lot of reluctance to maximizing therapy. Ken?
Well, that's what I wanted to tweak you on for just a second, because right there's a huge logical disconnect between what you write in debate issue 3 and what you wrote in debate issue 2, where you said your whole intent was to evaluate how these systems are going to end up being used in the real world. And here you're deliberately saying you don't want to evaluate how they're going to be used in the real world.
Well, of course, we want both and everything.
I think this is a great, great discussion. And the reality is we have the status of heart failure that we have in the U.S. and Europe, and we have a lot of hospitalizations taking place. So I think we do have to relate it to the real world. And physicians and nurses are doing the best they can. And as Jeff said, you can't always get them to targeted dose. So I think we have to relate it to the real world and go for maximally tolerated dose. And there are certainly examples that we saw in Champion that Bill pointed out where you've got a patient whose PA pressures are very high, the physician's uncomfortable increasing their beta blocker. They are able to titrate the diuretic, get the PA pressure down, then they can raise up the Coreg a little bit more. So we see this sort of positive synergy, and we want to take advantage of that.
Oh, we'll find more.
I think this is the last one, and then I've really been told that we've got to cut it off because the next group is going to be coming in here.
So last, quality of life assessments are meaningless in non-blinded trials. And objective methods of functional capacities need to be included in these trials.
Not opinions, just discussion.
Yeah, I don't actually agree with point A about that quality of life assessments are meaningless in non-blinded trials. I think that it's difficult. Obviously, much more difficult to interpret the outcome of QOL assessments if there's no blinding. But the magnitude of change can be employed in making reasonable decisions about the interpretation of such data, I believe. I know there are people who don't think that that's true, but I believe that can be done. The objective methods of functional capacity need to be included. I think that's wonderful. The problem is that we don't know which one tracks with clinical outcome. So I think it's fine to measure them to provide biological plausibility, perhaps, but we really don't know how to interpret those either.
And of course, the issue of blinding the quality of life assessments comes in, and I know we've had discussions in investigator groups about, you know, having the patient do it online. So then nobody sees the patient to know which group they fall into, because some of these are very difficult to blind. Cecilia, you had a point?
No, I totally agree with Jeffrey. I think quality of life measurements always give something, because even though the patient might be aware that they are subject to some kind of intervention, it's still going to differ so much in a heart failure patient. I think, irrespective of having a patient in a trial or not, I really think we should do this in our ordinary heart failure clinic to just get the additional piece of how the patient feels that might not get out in our history taking.
Yeah, I actually wanted to ask Ileana a question, because I just saw a recent publication in CIRC Heart Failure from the HF Action Group, from your group, comparing six-minute hall walk to metabolic exercise testing and suggesting, in terms of the incremental value in predicting prognosis, they were very much similar to one another. You know, we have long favored metabolic exercise testing as being more objective, but of course six-minute hall walk is much easier to do. Does your data now support using six-minute hall walk?
If you're trying to put me in a corner, no.
No, I'm just curious.
No, I think you're well taken. Yeah. Remember, this is done, again, in the context of a clinical trial where we were very specific about the measurement of the hallway and how it was done. So I think it provides a lot of information, particularly about low-level activity. The question about functional capacity could range anywhere from a New York Heart class to the peak VO2. I have always pushed more for a six-minute walk in the very sick, because that may be the most comfortable for them to do, and the peak VO2 is still the most objective. When we looked at our, and you know this, you were on, in the study, our Uber model, the peak VO2 came out far as predictive of death. So, you know, it still provides a predictive value, whereas the other one may tell you how much the patient can do at low level. So I see them as complementary, actually. And looking, I don't know if you were here in the session yesterday, you were in LVADS. We were talking about the Intermax registry that has been so fabulous about giving us mortality and adverse events. But when we look at functional capacity, we have very little data. So there's still a lot of these gaps that we don't know. All right, I want to thank everyone. Thank you, Andy, for providing these. And I want to thank the audience, and we will conclude this session. It's been great.